Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Progressive Bitcoiner. I'm your host, Trey Walsh, and today we have on the show Kyle Schneps, the VP of Public Policy at Foundry. And Foundry does Bitcoin mining services and a host of other things in the digital asset space. I invited Kyle on the show because I wanted to talk about Bitcoin regulation, Bitcoin on the ballot in 2024, and a lot of other things, letters being sent to miners, asking about energy use and all sorts of good stuff in this episode that really wanted to look to an expert like Kyle to talk about, because I know I've been getting a lot of questions on this, and it really affects a lot of things in terms of Bitcoin policy and politics and all of those things that we're really deeply concerned about and want to talk about on this show, because again, we're trying to pursue Bitcoin as this neutral money, and it's been getting really, really steeped into politics when oftentimes it really should not be. So we got down to kind of the facts of the matter in this episode and talked about a lot of these things going on. We talked about Bitcoin mining, energy, all of that good stuff in this episode. So hope you all enjoy that episode. And also you can feel free to share it with friends that have questions on how all of this works in the regulatory landscape. So really hope you all enjoy this episode and get a lot out of it. But as always, you can reach out to me at hello@progressivebitcoiner.com for any questions, any feedback relating to this or any of our other content. And be sure to check out our promo links in the show notes to Bitbox. If you want the best way to safely secure your Bitcoin, you've got to get a Bitbox. So you can go to bitbox.swiss/TPB and use promo code TPB to get 5% off your purchase there. And also SaaS mining. Speaking of mining, SaaS mining, 100% renewable mining. It is the best way to get Bitcoin directly to the wallet of your choice. I've been a customer with them for over a year and really enjoy the experience. And Kent and everyone over there at SaaS Mining are doing incredible work to make sure that they're doing things the right way and renewably with Bitcoin mining. So check out that promo link as well to get $50 off each and every miner you purchase through SaaS Mining. All right, I will let you get to the episode now, and we will see you again next week. Hey, Kyle, welcome to the Progressive Bitcoiner. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Trey. Happy to be here.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We've got a lot to discuss, a lot you had sent over for us to discuss. Excited as always to chat with you. All things regulation, mining. It's February 2024. We've got all this crazy political cycle, I guess, depending on how you look at it, nonsense or fun stuff to talk about as well. But, we did a Spaces a while ago. I know a lot of people listening might know who you are, maybe have seen some of the pieces that you've written that we've shared out here, I know from our platform and things like that. But do you want to give folks a little intro to who you are, maybe a little bit of your background? I think you got an interesting background too, and then what you're doing in the Bitcoin space.
Like Trey said, and you can probably see on the screen somewhere, I'm Kyle Schneps, and I am Vice President Public Policy at a company called Foundry. Little background on Foundry. Foundry is a company that's based in Rochester, New York. We focus on all things having to do with the Bitcoin ecosystem and Bitcoin mining. And so if you can think of something in the Bitcoin mining space, some area, we probably have an entire team devoted just to that, everything from logistics to machine trading. And of course, we're most famous for the Foundry USA pool, which is the largest in the world. Myself, as public policy person at Foundry, I focus a lot on working with and educating government officials, agencies, both at the state and the federal level, on Bitcoin and what Bitcoin mining is. And that often turns into discussions about energy or national security and a whole host of things. And that's one of the really wonderful things about Bitcoin, is that it touches on nearly every aspect of life, as money often does. Mm-hmm. And my background, I come from about 10 years in the government. I started out as a White House fellow during the Obama administration, went on to work as a diplomat, work in the intelligence community, and also before that had worked for the United Nations Millennium Development Goals in monitoring and evaluation and evaluating the implementation of those goals in Africa. And so have had a very international career, but have finally found my calling in working for Bitcoin. It was a kind of a lifelong dream. and working for Foundry and in the Bitcoin ecosystem. So that's kind of where I am now.
Yeah, and I think you're, given that prior experience, at least from what I've found from you, when talking about domestic policy, public policy, Bitcoin mining, I think too, whether it's intentional or not, from what I've seen, you bring a lens of someone, whether it's outside of politics, anything like that, that has had that international experience. Because I've been talking with a lot of people recently, I think Bitcoin, whether it's Bitcoin regulation, Bitcoiners that tend to be the loudest, it's a very US focused thing. And I think some of us that have done some studying of other parts of the world, done some travels of other parts of the world, having that lens and looking into domestic affairs with that lens. And then with something like Bitcoin that is a global asset, start to look at things a little bit differently and are able to engage with folks in a much different way outside of, you know, things we like to talk about on this podcast, outside of that left-right divide, that kind of polarized divide. You've got some interesting takes, I think, as well on energy that we'll be sure to get into, you know, domestic and worldwide, and views on competition and things like
and
that.
And to your point, I mean, so I'm also one of the co-founders with two of my colleagues, Jason Browder, does policy for Marathon, and my colleague Alex Brammer, who's also in the industry. We founded this organization called BTC Bets, and it's all different U.S. military veterans and folks from the national security community who are advocating for Bitcoin. It's a big part of what we do. And then in a recent trip to the Hill, I was asked by a congressional staffer, you know, I think it was the chief of staff to a senator, who asked me, you know, why are so many national security people coming in lately and talking about Bitcoin? It's like, because we've all lived internationally and we've seen and lived in the places where it is so much needed. And I've told the story a few times about my first experience with Bitcoin, which was in West Africa. I was sick with malaria and the nurse was telling me how she doesn't trust her government because they've been rife with corruption. And so she was saving in Bitcoin. I wish I was as smart as her back then. But yeah, those are the types of little stories where you get exposed to something and they come back to you when you start to go down the rabbit hole.
Well, let's jump right in. You mentioned the BTC Vets, which is the org, and all of these, we'll mention probably several orgs and several newsworthy moments that I'll be sure to link in the show notes for people to reference. But there was a letter sent that I think many Bitcoiners will have seen in regard to Warren's digital asset, money laundering, yada, yada, yada bill that is, I'm not sure where it's at. It's at committee or has been proposed at committee. I'm sure you can give more background into that. But a letter speaking of intelligent officials, military officials, basically saying, hey, proceed with caution here. This seems to be a bit far reaching to say the least. So do you want to give some context into that letter, how that came about and the reasons for folks writing and signing on to it? There's about 80 or so intelligent officials, from what I understand.
Mostly military folks, mostly former military folks, some folks that are retired intelligence, some folks that were from, you know, retired treasury, that sort of thing. Basically 80 people who have government backgrounds. I'll kind of go back in time and try to sum up the history of this. So the bill that we're talking about is a Senator Elizabeth Warren drafted, sponsored bill called the Digital Asset Anti-Money Laundering Act. We'll just call it DAMLA. But I'd say about last summer, it was something that we were looking at and we were concerned and looked at this bill and it was glaring overreach and something that specifically it would apply the Bank Secrecy Act to even individual Americans who are just trying to self-custody their Bitcoin. So we were pushing back against it then, but the bill wasn't really going anywhere because it was so draconian. However, with the October 7th attacks in Israel, Senator Warren opportunistically use that attack to somehow create this idea of a crypto Bitcoin terror nexus based on some false data. And the Wall Street Journal ran with that story and they later had to retract it because it was so false. But it was enough to get the momentum in DC, because around that time when there is a national security incident that's so significant, a lot of policymakers want to do something, right? And that came across it, and it built some momentum.
It made me think of other events in history that I think a lot of progressives and folks from the left will remember and be wary of, with 9/11, the Iraq War, things like that.
Right.
I don't think this is to that degree with crypto policy, but anyway,
yeah,
same sentiment, I'd say.
There's parallels to be drawn to a certain extent. And so then it started, that bill started to get momentum, and it's quite draconian, as I mentioned before. It's something that attacks individuals who are custodying Bitcoin. It attacks miners that are mining it, right? And it would virtually try to end the Bitcoin and crypto industry in the United States. And so it's something that a lot of national security professionals, former ones, said, like, look, this is overblown. This is not accurate. And so we originally wrote a letter to Congress that said, you know, look, nobody wants any funding to go to terrorism, but let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater here. This is a fraction of a percent that is going to, and it's all from offshore exchanges, right? That is potentially going to Hamas. So this bill would have no effect on offshore exchanges anyway. And so let's have a constructive conversation here to see how industry and elected officials can work together and move forward from there. And Senator Warren wrote back to that original letter, and instead of addressing the substance of the arguments that were made in it, started claiming and sort of questioning the ethics of the people who wrote in, all the veterans that wrote in, and saying that we're part of some sort of revolving door between government and crypto. I mean, there's nothing more laughable than that. There are the major revolving doors between government is through, you know, government contracting companies, not through financial services, especially in digital assets. There's, you know, dozens of us, right? Like in Arrested.
Right. Yeah.
There are dozens of us. But I think the key thing here is that she went back and attacked all the veterans who wrote about this, and instead of addressing the arguments and being substantive. And so as a result, we then wrote back another letter, and this time, instead of 40 people signing it, we doubled our number to 80. And so I think that one of the messages we're trying to say is, hey, let's have a constructive dialogue here that doesn't try to eliminate tens of thousands of US jobs based on false data. And let's not use opportunistically serious conversations about national security in order to advance a political agenda. And I think those are legitimate concerns to have. And I think it's a different level when you have actual former government employees who have been trusted with a wide variety of different topics and now are coming to you and saying, hey, trust us on this too. Like, we know what we're talking about here.
Yeah, I mean, I think for anyone to not see how it's politically opportunistic is really missing the point. I mean, there are folks, ideally, there are folks that listen to our podcast that are crypto or Bitcoin curious, or maybe they hear us talking about some values they align with, but they're not into Bitcoin. You know, so, you know, somebody might come on here and see, you know, we've been pretty unapologetically against Senator Warren on a lot of these things. And I'm a resident of Massachusetts and a constituent. I've ridden to her office several times as a previous supporter and in previous elections of hers as well. It's quite sad. And I've said it many times on this platform to see the senator get wrapped up in this when she was such a fighter for the average American worker and against kind of banks and Wall Street overreach that led to things like the Great Recession in 2008, to then bash something without even putting forward the lightest facts. So again, every political party and many politicians do this, but really disappointing to see from someone that should be, in my view, and I know a lot of us get really sucked into the rabbit hole of Elizabeth Warren is the worst and this and that, especially Bitcoiners that aren't, you know, from the left, right? But I really take a step back sometimes and say, you know, Elizabeth Warren, understanding the values that she's positioned before, you know, truly, if she and her team just took a step to be given the freedom to explore Bitcoin and explore what it is, should have a different change of mind. And as you said, it's not like, you know, let's say there's data coming in that terrorists were using Bitcoin or whatever. It's not saying don't do anything. It's saying, okay, this law probably wouldn't do much in this case. And also the numbers were so overblown. And also, as I've said on this podcast, I'm like, we might need to do better police work rather than the wiretap approach of everything on the planet that was adopted post 9/11 with the Patriot Act. So how Democrats, progressives, the left, whoever can be so against and so on the same page with like the Patriot Act and things like that, that it happened, but not understand that this is using similar tactics that would really affect everyday Americans before Bitcoin's even given a real shot to see its full potential in the US. It does make me really angry. And I do go back and forth constantly with how much do I speak out on this? How much do I not? But it's really hard not to when it's so misaligned from something I think that is so good for people.
Yeah, and I really do. And I agree with you. It's easier to fall. It is easy to fall in the trap to vilify one person, especially in mm-hmm. this situation where it is so blatant that she's yeah. coming after the industry. However, you know, there is a lot of truth to the notion that, there's no doubt in my mind she thinks that she is doing the right thing here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In fact, I think Bitcoin, I know Bitcoin was created to solve a lot of the problems that she herself has said exist on Wall Street and with big banks, perhaps back in the days when she was talking about those sorts of things.
Yep.
And maybe one of the big differences here is that, you know, Bitcoin tries to solve those problems by decentralizing. Mm-hmm. And Senator Warren believes the solution to solving those problems is by more centralization into the government, by creating a central bank digital currency, by making government larger, mm-hmm. by making government more involved in the personal finances and the visibility and surveillance of people's money. And so I think that may be the big threat, is that Bitcoin is actually created to solve a lot of the problems she herself cares about, but it almost cuts the government out of the process. And I can imagine that would be quite alarming.
Yeah, for sure. And I think there's so many different ways to look at this. I think, and I've kind of come to this conclusion along the way, I think for folks to be, in my mind, because all the time people are like, okay, what makes someone a Bitcoiner? What makes someone really into Bitcoin? So on one end of the spectrum, you have to live and be like this. On the other end, well, anybody who owns Bitcoin is a Bitcoiner, right? I think I fall somewhere in the middle where I think in order to understand this message that you and I could talk about Bitcoin or any guest we have on the show of what it could do for humanity, decentralization, all of that, you have to come to a place where you see that, there is a problem that exists with the global financial system. And there's a problem that exists even with certain social programs or other programs that I might believe in as a progressive and kind of understanding that. How are we going to finance that forever? Like what's going on here? Like our national debt, like these things that are real with money and understanding money, you have to be willing to identify there's a problem that Elizabeth Warren can't really solve, even though she really wants to at the end of the day, to then be willing to sit here and sit down and say, let's take a look at Bitcoin. And I think until people do that, they'd probably be closed off to this message and you know, maybe accuse us of not really being truly progressive on certain things or certain things like that, which I don't really care about, whatever. But I think I've come to that conclusion when it comes to Elizabeth Warren or certain supporters. You've got to get to a point where you're saying, you know, Bitcoin isn't going to fix everything, but I sure as hell know a lot of these politicians and government have not been fixing and addressing things because we see the problem continues to get worse. So what do we do? Like, what do we do in these situations? That's the biggest question I always have.
Yeah, I think there's truth to that. And, you know, I think you mentioned from the progressive side, I mean, I think that a lot of what this country is dealing with in general on the population is trying to separate maybe progressive or conservative principles from the Democrat and Republican parties. And I think that there's a lot to be said for that, right? I mean, to have principles, I think, is the first, you know, to first principles, right? To have your principles and then try to find the party that most aligns, that may be one thing. But to have so much identity with a party that you're unable to see the faults within it were to disagree with it in any way, that's when we get some of the problems we're seeing today. And I think that's where we're getting such division, is that we can't even, you know, have certain issues that we agree on anymore. It's just like, this is the party line and we're going to toe it. I think that if Americans just, you know, it's one thing to be part of a party, but it's another thing to have the party be part of you, right? To have that identity with it, where it's something that you identify with, and therefore it's so hard to separate your own identity from the party, right? I think it's important to have the principles and not be just towing the party line, and that's where we get a lot of the division.
This episode of the Progressive Bitcoiner is brought to you by Zeus. Zeus is a self-custodial Bitcoin wallet for Android and iOS. The app features a built-in Lightning node that allows you to take full control of how you make payments on-chain and on Lightning. You can easily onboard to the Lightning network and let Zeus's Lightning service provider, Olympus, do all the heavy lifting for you. Or you can get more hands-on and curate your own Lightning channels with whoever you transact with most. Zeus has best-in-class privacy and allows you to have great peace of mind when sending and receiving Lightning payments. Not only does the Zeus team not want to know how you're using your money, but they're building things in a way that they can't know. There's also a first-of-its-kind Lightning address that will allow you to receive payments 24/7 to your mobile wallet self-custodially. This is a great solution for a range of people, for those who just want to have the technical ability to set up their own infrastructure, to nomads and dissidents that need to accept donations on the move. Other Lightning wallets don't give the users this level of control. In fact, many of them operate more like bank accounts that can be revoked and ultimately lead to you losing your money. With Zeus, you're in full control of your private keys and therefore can start to take full control of your financial destiny. Save 5% on LSP fees using code TPB in the access code under LSP settings. To learn more and to learn where to download, head to ZeusLN.com. And what's weird is there is more division and there isn't as well. I mean, obviously this has been talked about for a while, like media, I think politicians are really clinging to that party line, like whatever camp they're in. Okay. If Trump is the leader of the Republican Party, they're falling in line with Trumpism. If whoever on the left, if Joe Biden is the head of the Democratic Party for the time being, that's the party line. But you see the data, the rise in independents is like through the roof. People registering as independents. I think I mentioned this on this pod before. I don't know if I gave a timeline, but a couple of years ago now, I registered as an independent, like separated from the Democratic Party. And I've said from this platform, you know, I won't, as the Progressive Bitcoiner, endorse a politician, or I'd be very skeptical as a Bitcoiner and from this platform to really cheer heavily on a politician from the left or the right, whoever. And we're coming to this with progressive left values, that kind of thing, of which there are many and varied, and everyone is individual. So the division and party line is definitely there, but you're also seeing the dissatisfaction with DC and politicians on the rise. You're seeing, I think, the progressive movement has really lost its way post-Bernie, with people not knowing where to turn. So most of my friends and a lot of the people that have progressive values and would have been at Occupy and different Black Lives Matter protests and things like that, various amount of you pick the cause, have separated from politics and disengaged. So a lot of people are ripe for looking for something else. And that's where I hope Bitcoin can insert itself, for people looking for different solutions. So yeah, people are definitely feeling the party lines, but also a lot of people I know, I know some people would be surprised. I really do say, like, listen, a lot of progressives and folks on the left, they think a lot of the party politics is pretty ridiculous from the Democratic Party or from wherever, whether it's post-COVID hysteria, whether it's, you know, pick and choose which wars you support and don't on a given day, like all of this stuff. A lot of us are pretty like, hey, we're kind of done with this, but the values are still there. So I'm hopeful about what that could look like. It's not like everybody needs to go and register as independent or something like that, but there is this like rise of like, what are we doing? Which I hope will lead to more solutions and answers. Like we're ripe for that rather than, you know, continue being just really attached to like a party identity.
And it's such an interesting time to be alive too, as we're seeing right before our eyes, something that doesn't happen, you know, maybe every few generations, where you have almost fundamental shifts between the parties and in those underlying principles. I think sometimes, I mean, there are things going on, like you mentioned war policy, and without making any judgments on foreign policy right now, I can say that a lot of the stuff that I see going on the left side, on the Democrat side, is stuff that John Stewart would have been making fun of back in 2004, 2005, that I was laughing at, right? About some foreign policy from the Bush administration and forever wars and all of these things. And so we're really seeing on some major issues this almost switch. And it could have something to do with just the division from how people view Donald Trump. It could have to do with just who happens to be in power. But to see the switching some a little bit of the party lines has been interesting to me to watch.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be an interesting year. And I do what it feels right to kind of insert this topic. One of the things that, you know, we had touched on to talk about was, you know, Bitcoin being on the ballot in 2024. And I think we could have this conversation now and then in November be completely surprised in terms of, I don't know personally, because I've heard, you know, Dennis Porter, love the guy, really support his work in Satoshi Action. But sometimes I'm like, you know, Dennis, is Bitcoin going to be that big of an issue at the ballot box, right? You know, is it going to be this thing, right? I'm trying to step into normie world as much as possible, you know, with this podcast, with how I talk about Bitcoin, all of these things. Because some people would be like, Bitcoin is on the ballot, and if you don't support Bitcoin, you're going to lose all your voters, right? I'm curious your take on when you think about Bitcoin heading into this election cycle, or just, you know, crypto policy in general, which Bitcoin is a part of. How do you view that? How do you think about Bitcoin? And do you see it as something that will come up more and more as we get into this political cycle? I will say it obviously already has been a part of the discussion with many different candidates. So it is here. It is a part of the discussion, but I'm curious your thoughts on to what degree will it be a factor?
You know, Dennis is a good friend, and a part of me agrees with him, but to a certain extent, I think that for this election in particular, Bitcoin will be on the ballot in a certain sense. And this is the sense. Being supportive of Bitcoin, and let's just put it in political terms, like there's a lot of politicians out there, and I speak with them all the time, who make no differentiation between Bitcoin and crypto. But sure. from that, and we're trying to educate folks, and because it's important to understand the differences and why. From that angle, there is when you are pro Bitcoin, for instance, pro Bitcoin, pro crypto candidate, let's just call it, you can gain significant support simply on that. There are so many single issue voters. I think you have up to 50 million people across America who own some form of cryptocurrency. A lot of those are a lot of those own Bitcoin. You have communities of color across America who are gravitating to investing in this technology, right? Specifically Bitcoin. We have organizations like Black Bitcoin Billionaires. We have Harlem Bitcoin, right? All different organizations. The Kansas
City Bitcoin Transformation Community. Shout out Justin Redrick, Bitcoin Bacon.
The Kansas City Federal Reserve, or one of the Federal Reserves, came out with a study that showed that Black and Brown Americans, the only asset class that they're outpacing white Americans in investment in per capita is digital assets, is Bitcoin, right? And so this is a big thing, because this is people's future. This is their investment portfolio. They're inclined to vote for something that's going to expand their portfolios. They're inclined to vote for technologies they believe in. And Bitcoin is one of them that has some of the most passionate followers around. Now, I bring this up because you can gain a lot of people by supporting this industry, a lot of voters, right? A lot of support. There is no upside. And this was the gist of an op-ed I wrote last year. There is no upside at all to being anti-Bitcoin in the voting booth. There is nobody who is sitting on the fence between two candidates or two parties, and they hear the person's anti-Bitcoin, they say, okay, I'm going to vote for that guy. It is not a winning issue to be anti-Bitcoin. You can only gain supporters by being pro. And so I think that is a huge thing. And so the smart political move here is to be supportive of an industry with tens of thousands of jobs, of a technology with millions of investors or hodlers or people who believe in the underpinning philosophies of it. There's only an upside to supporting that. there is no upside to being anti. And so when you hear the Warren line about an anti-crypto army, well, you may have an anti-crypto army of maybe appointed bureaucrats, but unfortunately, voters do not vote for people because they are anti-crypto. It just doesn't exist. And so I think that's a major part of what's coming up of Bitcoin being on the ballot. And the second big thing is, to expand upon what you mentioned before, is that we have an unprecedented amount of talk about Bitcoin by major political candidates, right? Bitcoin will be talked about at a presidential debate if there is one this year, right? If there is a debate between presidential candidates this year, there will be a talk of Bitcoin. They're already asking Donald Trump about it. They've asked every other candidate what their position is. And I think that on the Republican side, they're starting to realize that it is a vulnerability to be anti this industry or this technology. And so I think it will be play a factor this year. Now, 4, 8, 12 years, it may be so. I hope it's so ingrained in our society that it's not as questioned.
Yeah, I do hope it gets to a point where it's silly to even talk about it in this way. One of the first things, you know, once my wife hears me ramble on about it all the time, and it's probably about a year ago, she's like, if it's just money, then like what, like why all the politics, why this and that? I was like, great point. I hope at some point we get to a point where it's just like, can we stop talking about like Bitcoin so much? It's just money. Or, you know, can we talk about, okay, we've got all these Bitcoin industries and these businesses accepting Bitcoin. Let's talk about the things it's doing, not like the thing. Let's get past like Bitcoin, the thing. Like it is technology. It's here. All of these things. I like that take on it. And I think you may have tweeted or written about it as well. I remember that sticking to me in terms of like, yeah, there's only an upside here. And I do personally feel less and less that when I bring it up to friends or when I see other progressives or left-leaning people that I really respect that are not into the space, but they're tapped into what I would consider the culture or younger generations, you see that they're cringing less or that they're net neutral on it or that they're not speaking up too much about it. Or maybe they're slightly engaging in conversations with it. Interesting to me.
This is a purely generational issue. And in fact, at times, I know it seems, especially from reading the news or whatever, that Bitcoin is something that is starting to develop into a partisan issue between Republicans, Democrats, left, right. Mm-hmm. There is inklings of that. But honestly, it is much more generational. We are seeing that it is the policymakers, doesn't matter what party they are, but 70 and older are really much more skeptical about Bitcoin than younger generations. The younger elected officials, it doesn't matter if they're Republican, Democrat, they're supportive of this. It could be, you know, Richie Torres on the left. It can be Byron Donalds on the right, right? Mm-hmm. There is a support for this and a comfort with this technology. And we see that all around the world. I think that's why Bitcoin is so prominent in Africa, or at least growing in prominence in Africa, because you just have a young population that's much more comfortable with digital assets, with digital technology.
It goes back to my point of this US-centric echo chamber, whether it's folks in Bitcoin, folks in politics. It's good to tap out of that for a little bit. You know, if someone had the luxury of literally, getting out of the country, traveling, living abroad somewhere, you know, you can get out for a few months and then come back, and it's toning down a bit, toning up a bit in some ways in terms of like the environmental rhetoric has gotten a little bit better, some more support for it, toned down a little bit in terms of Greenpeace's attacks, in terms of the shifting, I don't know if people have noticed, and I've mentioned this before, the change the code rhetoric. Well, where did that go? They realized it's not, they've shifted that narrative. They said, let's forget the way it's been shifted, but it's not change the code anymore as much. It's more of clean up Bitcoin. That's what it is. Now, there's a distinct difference, changing the code versus, okay, let's be more responsible with the electricity we're generating for Bitcoin. So that was an interesting shift. So that shift has been happening in the US, but I completely agree with you on the generational divide. It's not talked about enough compared to the political divide, but that's a huge point. It's definitely a generational divide. I agree with that. You had mentioned too, speaking of energy, your different views on, obviously, into Bitcoin mining, and anybody that's really into Bitcoin mining and services is also deeply entrenched in understanding of energy, which I got a crash course. I feel like getting into Bitcoin and caring about the environment of Bitcoin mining, learning about energy markets, the grid, which I had no experience and understanding of. And I firmly believe if climate activists got a little more of that, they'd understand what we're on about, because it's hard to detach those two. But you had sent over just talking about global energy perspectives. I'll make sure I get this right. A holistic approach to energy versus exclusionary approach among countries and kind of competition or even states, because we see that a lot in the United States as well. And obviously, I think you're in an interesting spot where you're based in New York. There's been some interesting, I don't think politics, I think some people would have assumed a bit more hostility in New York, which there is and isn't. I think it's a bit complicated on the mining front, including the you know, New York ban that we've that you touched on. I think we touched on in a Spaces probably last fall, but you've talked about before as well, with new emissions generating Bitcoin mining versus like Texas, where people are considered, you know, Texas is, oh, you know, home of Bitcoin mining, and you gotta move your operation to Texas. So talk to me a little bit about that in terms of your views on energy and Bitcoin around the world.
So I think what we're seeing is, from a governance perspective, a kind of bifurcation, a division of how governments are viewing their approach to energy. So I think on one hand, we have a holistic approach to energy. So I was just speaking at a conference in Dubai in the UAE, and they have embraced every aspect of energy production, right? So they've developed nuclear facilities, they have solar and wind and oil and gas and a wide variety of different approaches to energy, all going at the same time. And I view this as kind of a holistic approach. And I think that a lot of countries are going this route. It is an acknowledgement of trying to limit maybe an over-reliance on fossil fuels by exploring other avenues. Now, I think alternatively, we see in a lot of Western governments an exclusionary approach to energy, where they have picked a couple types of energy. I would say solar and wind are the biggest ones, which have been labeled with a moralistic, have been given a moralistic label, which is like, these are good. And for instance, nuclear, which is cleaner than them all, is bad. And so we see one of the best examples of this is New York State. So New York State has banned nuclear energy. They closed their, the Indian Point nuclear facility, and they're not developing anymore. They have like a de facto ban on natural gas exploration. They have banned a wide variety of energy sources. And then when it comes to solar and wind, they have incredible trouble building solar and wind because of NIMBYism, right? Not in my backyard. I don't want to look at that. I don't want to, see the windmills and that sort of stuff. And so as a result of this, in that particular state of sort of a, what we would view as a progressive energy policy, right, in New York State, or at least a far left-leaning energy policy, yeah, in New York.
Let's call it the Green New Deal approach. Yeah, I think Green New Deal. Unless you disagree with that, kind of in that realm. Yeah,
sure. Green New Deal approach to energy. The result is that 10 years ago, New York City functioned on 85% of fossil fuels. After 10 years of Green New Deal policies, they function on 85% fossil fuels. So there is no growth and there's no expansion. And so one of the things we tried to explain in New York and other places that view this exclusionary, that take this exclusionary approach to energy, is Bitcoin mining fills a huge gap. It wasn't invented for this, but now it does. is that if you have renewable energy production facilities, solar, wind, that are not so profitable or are, you know, of course, intermittent in how they can produce energy, Bitcoin can come in and use stranded energy. It can monetize at the source, and it can help private renewable energy companies expand to create more renewable energy. This explanation was met with Bitcoin bad. And so, you know, it's very frustrating at times, but I think the more we can convey this message and the more we can show it being successful in places like Texas, I think the better we will be. And so New York is just one example. I think it's generally how a lot of countries are viewing this. Are we going to be a holistic and explore every natural resource and man-made resource for energy that we have available? Or are we going to exclude certain types of energy in favor of others? And I think that the holistic approach is going to be much more successful for countries because our energy usage will only go up exponentially in this world. It is only going up.
Hi, everyone. Hope you're enjoying the episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Bitbox. Now, Bitbox is a hardware wallet that's open source, incredibly secure and easy to use, and it's what I'm using to safely secure my Bitcoin in cold storage. Now, I know self-custodying Bitcoin can really be intimidating, but Bitbox is designed for ease of use without compromising on security. It's USB-C compatible and allows you to easily back up and restore your private keys with a micro SD card, which is really cool. Now, you can purchase the Bitbox using the promo code TPB at the link found in the show notes for 5% off your purchase. And I really want to thank Bitbox for their support of the podcast, and I'm really excited about this new partnership. All right, I'll let you get back to the episode now. Yeah, I think, and the one thing I learned too coming into Bitcoin, because people will ask me, you know, have your values shifted? Do you find a lot of Bitcoiners, which in the US, let's just, I'm not saying good, bad, or whatever, they're still largely the ones that are most vocal or more kind of conservative, US libertarian leaning, that kind of thing in the space. So I used to get a lot, oh, have your values changed? Are you less progressive now and this and that? And I'm like, no, my values are still the same. Like, I personally believe there is a climate crisis we are still dealing with. I hold a lot of these progressive values that I still think about, like marginalized communities, systemic racism, so many of these things. Well, I think once I started really learning about energy, like I had a sociology background, like I work in nonprofits, I didn't really know about energy and grids and how a lot of this worked. I just heard, okay, there's a climate crisis and we need to ban fossil fuels now. And I probably would have been like, yeah, like, hell yeah, that sounds great. Like, let's do it. Okay. Well, once I learned at the end of the day that there are more statistics like what you're saying, where that approach leads to, okay, things could get more expensive for poor people. Okay, actually, renewables haven't been built out and we're at the same place we were. Once I started seeing it, a lot of it was optics and just speech, I began to get more and more and more frustrated over the years, seeing that I want to focus on, like, what are the actual solutions? How are we actually going to get there? Well, one of the ways we're actually going to get there is by being more smart with our approaches. Like you're saying, that balanced energy mix, and then approaching Bitcoin as a potential option in some markets to expand renewables, but there has to be that profit incentive. It cannot be driven by government in some markets and areas. And once I started learning about that, I'm like, oh my God, this opened up. I got really excited, but also I'm like, okay, man, I want to do a lot of education through this podcast, through my friends, through so many other people doing such great work, like Margot, Troy, Daniel Batten, so many people writing amazing stuff on this. I want those climate activists that are so angry and upset for so many good reasons about how greed and a disregard for our world has taken over a lot of these corporations from the past. But I'm like, the way we're approaching things, whether it's at the government level or at the activist level, it's not getting there. There's an organization that I really actually like, that, you know, is kind of big on social media and things like that, called Earthrise out of the UK. And they talk a lot about the environment, climate crisis, things like this. They've begun to do a series, which I was like, this is really great, talking about how even the transition to renewable energy is not what it's cracked up to be right now. More people are talking about the cobalt mines. More people are talking about how digging for a lot of these renewable sources, it's not as clear cut as we might think. You have to think about the full cycle of what it takes to generate that panel or generate a Tesla or whatever it is. And let's see, is there greenwashing going on with these corporations, right? So I think at the heart of my progressivism is a bit of a distrust of these corporations, a distrust of things. So you're starting to see more people open up about that as well. But I completely agree. I think going back to what you had said, I think part of it too with Bitcoin or any of these conversations, even just about kind of the grid and moving to more renewables, is playing this long game. And can, you know, Bitcoiners and those of us that are talking about these things, and those of us are willing to have these conversations, which is like, yeah, we want to get to more renewable energy. I think that's really good for everyone involved, whether it's price action, the environment, things like that. It's a long game approach. Now, the conversation you were having with folks like in New York, when do you think that started, where they were met with such resistance of Bitcoin? And where do you feel like that is at today in terms of talking about Bitcoin and its relationship to energy and the grid and things like that?
In New York specifically, I feel like a lot of that momentum came with some mining that was happening on Seneca Lake, and a large, it was just a political issue, right? And they seized upon it, and they thought it was something that, you know, some of the organizations could raise money on and different things. But I mean, we're still experiencing what I think of as the cycles of FUD, and they're usually opportunistically seized upon by what's in the media. And it's either from an energy environmental perspective of a vector of attack on Bitcoin. If it's not that, it switches over to national security when there is some sort of event like we've seen. And if it's not that, it goes to criminality. Criminals are using it, ransomware. And so these are sort of the three vectors of attack. I feel that the more energy savvy an elected official is, the more they understand maybe where their energy comes from. And I find this for all people, I should say, but the more they start to understand how a grid works, or these are things that a lot of us, like you said, didn't even start to understand before we got into Bitcoin, right? Because it touches on so many aspects of life. And so when you start to understand, I think, how a grid works and like how power is generated and from what types of sources. I heard a great sort of analogy, and it was the first time I had heard it, but the idea is that a lot of our power energy sources and providers and the grid, like everything is kind of designed to run at 60 miles an hour. And what I mean is I'm making like a car comparison, right? Like we get better gas mileage on the highway when we're just running at 60, right? And we're just steady, as opposed to being in a city, use a lot more gas and energy when you're just like constantly, you know, braking and stopping. And I think a lot of our energy systems are built that way. And unfortunately, because of the human activity cycle, right? We're more active during the day, less at night. It breaks a lot on us. And so Bitcoin comes in and it helps smooth out that system, right? It helps support the grid in that way. And it helps us run kind of smoothly at 60 so we get the most out of our energy production and our grid. And I think that's a great way to talk about it. And I hope that more policymakers will be open to those conversations. And I think that hopefully we'll have to convince some members of the media of that as well, because a lot of the elected officials get what they know about the industry or Bitcoin from the media.
Well, we'll have to do a whole nother episode on incentives in politics, because that's let's institute some term limits, some other things might make it easier. But this is a good transition into kind of the last major point I wanted to cover with you, which was U.S. Energy Information Agency. So I know EIA sent letters. To most, if not, well, probably all the public miners. I'm not sure if it's extended past
82 companies. Yeah.
82 companies. See, there's a reason you're on. You're the expert here to ask these questions to not be trying to remember the latest in the FUD report. So a letter sent by this agency wanting to ask about the energy use of these miners, which a lot of folks in the space interpreted as quite the overreach and asking for quite a lot of data that didn't seem to be very... it seemed to be out of the ordinary. Let's put it that way. So do you want to expand and explain a little bit more about these letters and where things stand today?
Yeah. So the Energy Information Agency is technically within the Department of Energy, although in large part considered an independent offshoot of the Department of Energy. But the EIA is charged with collecting information having to do with energy and all different things, collecting data. And recently they sent, like you mentioned, 82 letters, 82 surveys to Bitcoin miners that contained very invasive language about, you know, all different things that are proprietary to these businesses. You know, copies of their electricity bills and a wide variety of things. You can look up the actual survey. Now, the weird part about this is that it wasn't just sent as a survey, please fill this out, we would appreciate it. What they did was they went to the they went into the Office of Management and Budget, which is part of the White House, and they requested an emergency. So an emergency to be declared in order to compel companies to answer the survey. Yep. And so if you didn't answer it, you could be subject to jail time, $10,000 a day for every day that you don't respond. So very severe penalties. And the emergency was claimed to be a winter grid emergency based on some of the things that happened in Texas. But meanwhile, Bitcoin miners are actually supporting grid resilience by taking a lot of energy from times that people are not using energy and curtailing their load, especially in winter. There was lots of curtailment in Texas. Curtailing their load so that people can have access to energy during extreme emergencies or extreme weather. And this is what happened very successfully throughout January in Texas and other places. So they sort of concocted this fake emergency in order to pressure miners to be able to compel Bitcoin miners' data centers to supply this information. Now, one of the first questions you have to ask is, okay, if there really is an emergency, why are we going to like 1% of the consumption in Texas? Like, wouldn't we try to go to all data centers, all commercial usage to see like, hey, how can we actually come up with some sort of solution to this emergency should it actually exist, which it doesn't. But they didn't. They used this just to target the Bitcoin data center community. And so it's something that a lot of people feel was politically motivated. The head of that agency was specifically asked by Elizabeth Warren during a hearing, do you even know how many Bitcoin mining facilities there are, how much energy is using? So there was sort of an indirect ask there. And yeah.
Can I pause you there really quick? Because I hadn't quite heard that take. And this, you know, this podcast, I never really design it to have like clickbaity quotes or, you know, things like this, just try to like analyze facts and talk about things as truthfully as possible. But in that moment, like, what weight do you put on that question from Elizabeth Warren to the agency leading to these letters? Obviously, there's so many different folks in DC that are quite either ignorant or outright against, you know, Bitcoin mining and things like this. So there's plenty of people. It's not, like we said, it's not just one person. But do you think that really caused some dominoes for people in the agency to be like, wow, we're kind of embarrassed now. We really should know this. Or do you think there was a follow-up conversation or anything like that that really led to these letters? Like, do you think that could have been the moment, or do you think these things might have been in the works already?
I think that no head of an agency, nobody testifying at a hearing, especially from a friendly politician, right? So sure. You have a Democrat testifying before a Democrat. Those are supposed to be some of the like softballs.
Yep.
And I think that is, nobody wants to be caught flat-footed in those situations. And sure. So I'm sure it caused some action I speculated it did. Whether or not there were follow-up on conversations, I couldn't know that. But I would imagine that if you're the head of an agency and you're asked a question and you have no idea what the answer is, you're going to probably bring that up when you get back.
Yeah.
When you get back to work.
Sure. Or the door will be open. Next agency, lower agency. Yeah. So, I mean, there's so many different takes here. And I think, again, for those stumbling in, I'll try to dumb it down even further. Like a reminder, like Bitcoin mining looks very similar to other data centers. There's tons of Amazon data centers and AWS, you know, just outside of DC. It's computers, it's data centers. I always have mixed feelings about the term mining and why we decided that years and years and years ago, you know, as a community, haven't changed it up, but yeah. So it's a data center. And, you know, I forget if it was Troy Crosser who kind of joked in the past about, we got to make sure we keep the, you know, the porn data centers on, right? You know, during these, right. We got to keep those up and running, but we need to shut down the Bitcoin ones that actually are, you know, operating at off peak hours and things like this. It's just, it's maddening. And I wonder, sometimes I think in 5-10 years, and I wonder if you share this sentiment, that we will look back on this and say, wow, it was, this was kind of like Red Scare. This is just, it's kind of insane when you look back on it. Or do you think the worst is yet to come with some of these things? Because it depends on administration too, of course. But that could go either way. If we have a Trump-Biden administration, that's a whole nother conversation too. I'm not sure Trump is the most friendly to some of these actions quite yet. I think it's a bit of a wild card, but what are your thoughts on where we're headed? Is this kind of the beginning of the end, or just the beginning in terms of
I agree activities? With you. It's going to depend on elections this year are going to be important for, and again, everything we're talking about here, you know, I can hear probably some people listening like, you know, government can't kill Bitcoin. Yes, you are 100% right. Bitcoin is designed and decentralized to survive and not be controlled or be able to be destroyed by any government.
Yes.
But they certainly can slow it down. They certainly can slow down the adoption that we want to see in our lives, our children's lives, right? And the good that can bring out. And they can certainly slow it down. And they can also move it out of country. I think that none of the people listening or the Americans listening want to see Bitcoin moved offshore, right? Or companies that are supporting the network, you know, whatever it may be, securing the
jobs, so many opportunities for actually controlling, maybe having a bit more renewable energy rather than firing up coal plants in Russia and China to do Bitcoin mining. So many advantages here.
Right. And so we want to see it flourish in a place where I think a lot of Bitcoiners can understand that there are key similarities, almost, I think, key traits that are undergird the U.S. Constitution and also undergird the principles of Bitcoin. And this is, I think, one of the places that this technology should flourish. And I do think that politics can slow it down. I hope it doesn't. That's why we work so hard. That's why Foundry empowers me to go and educate lawmakers and try to do that. But I think it's something that we have to continue fighting for, because there are a lot of aspects of this technology that threaten the status quo. And when you have a disruptive technology, it doesn't matter what it is, we're always going to experience that. So that's kind of my best way of answering that big question.
Like I said, I mean, never a dull day in Bitcoin, as we could try to predict these things. Yeah, there was a clip, because I know Dennis, at the time of this recording, we're always kind of a couple of weeks out in terms of conversations from when they actually air. But Dennis Porter was just recently on Peter's What Bitcoin Did show. And, you know, Dennis, if I butcher the quote, it was something to the effect of, like, I know Bitcoiners don't necessarily care about government, but government cares about you. And you were still an American, a U.S. citizen that might have trouble accessing Bitcoin in a self-custodial way, depending on, you know, Elizabeth Warren's you know, legislation and same like that. Same with businesses and miners, right? Like, yes, the Bitcoin network, my personal belief, it's not that this thing is inevitable, but I do think that, like you said, like we saw the China ban, you know, hash rate dip for not that long and then roared again. So the Bitcoin network is global. It could be very well interplanetary at some point. Like this is, it's going to be around. Like it's like the internet. Cause some people are like, well, what if the internet shuts off? I'm like, well, we got bigger problems. If you know the internet is hacked and shuts down, then just I won't care as much about Bitcoin in those moments. I'll probably care about safety and
you know, a lot of other stuff. I've heard that's ridiculous. Well, what are you going to do with your Bitcoin if there's no more electricity on Earth? It's like then we got bigger issues.
Yeah, a lot of people are going to die. Like
we're going to have some cash from the ATM.
Exactly. Yeah. So, again, I completely agree. You know, I think Bitcoin is here. I think it's unstoppable in so many ways. But the way you are able to interact with Bitcoin under the law in terms of your country, we should care about these things. We should talk about these things and be adamant about it.
And maybe to get back to, you know, your original question that I digressed on, I mean, I think what we're dealing with in Texas and trying to get all of this data from specific Bitcoin mining data centers, right? Is trying to put the spotlight on one type of data center and ignoring the rest. And you can't do an effective study without context, right? That you cannot do an effective study without contextualizing, okay, this is how much Bitcoin data centers are using compared to all data centers. This is how much all data centers are using compared to manufacturing industry. Like, how do we know the context of this? And so when you think about that and you're just pigeonholing or shining a spotlight on one particular segment of society, it's obviously intended to create headlines that are ridiculous. Like we've seen, right? You know, Bitcoin uses more energy than Norway and these things, but what they're missing in those headlines is, but so does every single other major industry in the world use more energy than Norway. And so I think we really need to have that context, and that's what's missing. And that's why the Texas Blockchain Council is litigating this and pushing back.
So where do things stand right now with the litigation, with the letters that have gone out? What happens from here?
Well, as of now, and I'll say this probably before this airs, but we have a temporary stay, and it looks like that the original ruling by the judge in Texas was in favor of the Bitcoin, of the Texas Blockchain Council's suit. Mm. And so they are looking at, you know, some sort of period of weeks that pauses the forced nature of the emergency, right? That pauses, that allows Bitcoin mining companies to not have to respond to the survey right away.
Yeah. And it was the Texas Blockchain Council, right?
Yes.
I just want to give them a huge shout out for their work.
Absolutely. Huge shout out to Lee Bratcher at Texas Blockchain Council and to Riot and Brian Morgenstern and those folks
stepped up as
plaintiffs. So this is a big, you know, a nice initial victory, but there's going to be several following steps in order to, you know, make sure that we are not being compelled forcibly by the government to submit surveys that are invasive and based on an emergency that is false.
Yeah. And some people, maybe too many people aren't thinking this, but some might. It's like, okay, you know, we're talking about, like, you know, legalese stuff. We're talking about these like big Bitcoin mining corporations, and I know you work for Foundry, you know, all of these other things. It's like, what are we on about as the progressive Bitcoiner talking about these things, talking about this? Well, the reality is a lot of this hashing power and a lot of this narrative around Bitcoin mining, like, yes, in this case, you know, Riot was involved and many other public miners. Separate the public miners, corporations, Wall Street, all of this. It's a narrative about Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining. And these are kind of, in my opinion, baseless attacks on this industry, which would affect people being able to access Bitcoin, especially if people are distracted by political narratives, which, again, some Bitcoiners are like, Trey, like, literally will tell me, Trey, this doesn't matter. You know, everyone gets Bitcoin at the price they deserve. Like, they'll get to it and learn about it when they do. Well, it really pisses me off when people do these kind of baseless claims against Bitcoin mining, let's actually have some merit-based claims about it. Let's actually talk about it. If a company is doing some dirty Bitcoin mining, let's talk about it. Let's like address that. Let's actually be factual about it rather than Bitcoin bad, Bitcoin mining bad. This goes on down the line. So I care about it because I want as many people, especially people who need it, especially marginalized communities, to learn about Bitcoin, to hold Bitcoin and have better savings, because we have a really uncertain future. And I'm much more certain on Bitcoin than I am in other things in life right now. So that's why I care about these conversations. It's not about, I want riot. Several of the people at Riot have reached out. They're great people. You know, this isn't about me trying to say, I want Riot and Texas, you know, Bitcoin miners to be the most successful. It's not about that. But a lot of this is baseless claims that has this domino effect of people wanting to smear Bitcoin at all costs because either they really want to or they're ignorant. Either way, it leads to the same result. So that's why we talk about this on this show, because I think it really can get in the way of adoption, as silly as that sounds. But like you said, you know, I think you and I probably share this a bit, like Bitcoin feels a bit inevitable, but that timeline, you know, it can happen a bit quicker for people that really need it if we address, you know, truth in these matters. So that's what frustrates me most.
Yeah, I think you're right on there. And, you know, it's important to remind folks that, you know, these Bitcoin miners are the backbone of proof of work, right? One of the key breakers of Bitcoin. Like it is the backbone of the network. And so we need that security, and we need a lot of the things that they provide. And honestly, the attacks by the government have the least effect on the larger companies. It is the smaller miners that can get wrapped up and be put out of business by some of these actions.
Yeah, they can't pay for it.
And so that's one of the problems with this as well, is that it usually, just like the bid license in New York, right? It has it's disadvantageous to the little guy. The big companies that it can afford, the millions of dollars of application fees and all that stuff, they can get their bid license. But it's
kind of like in the crypto broader land of kind of the market and actually selling Bitcoin, like Coinbase, right? They can afford these monumental legal fees. Different topic, but same principle. Yeah.
And there's so many aspects of participating with government that, or at least trying to influence the processes, that can smooth out, hopefully, Bitcoinization or whatever you want to call it, but at least level the playing field stop the constant cycle of attacks that come towards Bitcoin. And so hopefully with more education, hopefully with new, younger leaders, especially as they go older into positions of power, there will be major changes and we'll be able to smooth that runway, as you said. But it's certainly a bit rocky now. It's certainly a bit rocky. And so we're doing our best, I can assure you of that.
Well, before I let you go, I'm curious, do you have any, you know, wild card predictions or theories in this upcoming election cycle in terms of Bitcoin, in terms of candidates? You know, hell, if you say, RFK is just going to tear it up, going to end up on the ballot at the end of this, you know, right now it's looking very much so like it's going to be Trump Biden, which most of America literally does not want. And my fear on the progressive end, that I feel like we're getting a bit better on the environmental narrative and even the politics of talking about how Bitcoin can actually work for some progressive value stuff and stuff outside of the environment. My worry is that I feel like I'm going to have to try a bit more and coalesce behind the scenes to encourage Democrat voters heading into this election cycle that Bitcoin is good. We like Bitcoin because, you know, I feel like there's going to be a lot of rhetoric from probably the Republican side on Bitcoin, which then will make Democrats say Bitcoin bad. The whole thing, repeat, rinse, repeat. So curious, do you have any, you know, crazy theories out there in terms of the upcoming election cycle?
I mean, one of my biggest hopes is that I want Bitcoin to be as nonpartisan as possible.
This might surprise people, but I do as well.
Yeah.
It's one of the main goals. Yeah.
I would love for this technology to flourish and just it not be a political hot button or hot issue. like I said, I think Bitcoin plays for Bitcoiners a huge role in the presidential election. Just in, if it's even mentioned, I think Bitcoiners will be like, I can't believe that presidents, like the president of the United States, is talking about Bitcoin on a national stage. I, of course, think it will be minuscule compared to the larger issues that are facing the country that will be decisive, from immigration to foreign policy. But I will say that if there's been any time where I think a third party candidate has got a shot, even if it's minuscule, I just think that, who knows what can happen. I think there was this, a lot of people talked back in 2016 about this sort of Molotov cocktail vote, if you remember that sort of phrase, of people who were just sick of they were not happy with Hillary Clinton. They weren't happy with anything. And so they were just like, I'm voting for Trump. And I think that if you're going to have a Molotov cocktail vote this year, people are going to go independent. Now, it remains to be seen who that helps and who that hurts. But I think that having a third party candidate find any success is not a 1-year process. It will take multiple 4-year cycles of that number getting bigger and bigger. So they get 5% and then they're at 7% and then they're at 12%, right? And so that sort of thing needs to keep growing to where you have a viable third party candidate sometime in the future. But that would be my biggest thing, is like, maybe this is the year where that starts, where the third party candidate starts to get a little bit more. And obviously, RFK Jr., whatever you think about him, we can at least all agree that he is very pro Bitcoin.
He's very pro Bitcoin. And I mean, all of these candidates, but him especially, there's certain takes that I would find interesting and certain I would not. I think, you know, it's always important every election cycle. This is the hope I have, because I do think it'll just end up Trump and Biden and we'll kind of go through the same rinse repeat for a little bit. But every cycle you get a little more conversation from an independent, or a little bit like in, you know, it happened years and years ago with Andrew Yang talking about, like, again, whatever people think about universal basic income, but talking about AI, talking about our world is changing. Like, these are important things to have discussed every cycle. It's important that Bitcoin will be coming up this cycle, regardless of what amount that plays into people's votes. It's an important part.
You know, you're talking about enough a topic for a whole nother show, but
yeah.
I can tell you for certain that the AI industry and AI data centers and major companies are looking at the attacks on Bitcoin, and they know it's coming for them.
Yes, it's already started to pivot from SEC, it seems, which some Bitcoiners are like, yes, they're going to leave us alone and they're going to move on to AI. But the world's intertwined. I mean,
you have that Digiconomist thing, right? That switch from electricity to water usage, and then applying now to the AI data centers as well. You know, that's sort of how those FUD papers, like the Digiconomist papers, are used. They're sort of funded by a government. Usually they're funded by grants. Because usually a government knows that what they want to tax, so they fund a grant, give it to the person who's going to write the ammunition, and then they give it back to the government. They say, hey, look, we've got this study that shows exactly what we wanted to say before. And so I think we got to look out for that. But I know that AI is in our rearview mirror looking at what we've been driving through, and they know that. And they will have a lot more resources than the Bitcoin industry, that's for sure, to push back on governments and Bitcoiners.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we'll have to schedule another episode already, because I love chatting about these things. And I think a lot of people too love hearing from, you know, your expertise. Like, you're someone in the industry, you've had a ton of experience in these avenues. So I really appreciate you coming on the show and discussing this. And maybe we'll have to, you know, record over the summer and things are going to look entirely different. I have no idea. It's going to be an exciting, terrifying, fun, beautiful year for sure.
100%. I'm happy to come back anytime. And any listeners or watchers, feel free to reach out to me on X. I'm happy to answer any questions that folks may have, or get into any debates that folks may want to get into.
And your username, I'll say it here in case people don't go on X, but it's Go Bank Yourself, which is such a great handle. Yeah, that's awesome. Awesome. Thank you so much, Kyle. Always a pleasure. And we'll do this again soon.
Thanks, Trey.